Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and thank you so much for being with us this evening. Tonight, we are going to be having a rather topic that is so close to my heart that sometimes I have been kind of pushing it away and not dealt with having too many guests on the topic, because I really wanted to find someone who I believed would be able to share some different perspectives on the subject that I also shared. So this evening, my guest is Scott Stevens. He is a journalist, former mutual fund industry executive, and he is also the author of the 2013 award-winning Every Silver Lining Has a Cloud, which is a book we are going to be discussing this evening. So tonight the topic, alcoholism and sobriety. And it's not always about the alcoholic or the family or just, you can't just like nitpick and say it's, you're doing something, you're affecting everybody else. So when you stop doing it, everything's going to be roses. Or the other family members who are sitting back saying, oh, you just keep on going, I'll buy all your alcohol for you, everything's great, and enable you. And then when you do something wrong, they're down your back. Or when you go to rehab and you say, I'm perfect, I'm 2 days coming home, and oh my goodness, look at what I'm coming back to. Or, I really don't have anyone else to help me. How can I get some help? There are so many 360 spins to this topic, and that's what we'll be talking about this evening. And I hope you, if you have any questions, please feel free to call in. The number is 424-258-9318, but please remember to push 1 so I can see that you'll be wanting to ask a question and your telephone number will light up. Otherwise, I won't know you're there. So tonight, I'd like to welcome Scott to the show. Scott, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Dr. Jeanette. I'm glad to be here, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about an important topic for me and for a lot of people.
And just as I've said in the beginning, it seems like there are so many different versions of the word, of alcohol and sobriety and drinking and not drinking, that sometimes I think that actually encourages the, I guess, the activity of it to be going on, because you could change it into so many different masks. You could say, I'm not a drinker. I'm doing it this way. I'm not a drunk. I'm doing it that way. You know, our family aren't problem drinkers. You know, we do it this way. Or, you know, in other words, it is such a chameleon of sort. Sometimes you almost have to, how do you nail down that snake to do something with it, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody
exactly.
can take it to so many different levels, right?
Even within the medical community, there's not a widespread agreement on the definition of what is moderate drinking. So then you get into a discussion of, is it one drink a night or 4 drinks a week? Well, what if you had all 4 of those drinks in 1 hour? Well, then you're a binge drinker. So we
right.
stick labels on this to try to define what is drinking. And then where my experience with Every Silver Lining Has a Cloud, talking about relapse and alcoholism, is we look at first abstinence, not drinking at all, and for some people they believe that's the end of alcoholism and it's not enough
right.
to just stop drinking. So then you begin the discussion about sobriety, and sobriety is a period of abstinence where your body is adjusting to not having a chemical in it that it craves. And then as you go through sobriety, you can reach a point where you're entering recovery. My belief about the disease of alcoholism is there is no cure for this. You always have it, so you're always in recovery. You can recover from some of the spiritual things that brought about your reasons for drinking, but there is an underlying genetic and chemical imbalance within the body that you always have the disease, just like cancer. You can bring it into remission during recovery and sobriety through abstinence, but as long as you have alcoholism, you are going to be faced with the prospect of what happens if I start drinking again. Well, you're still alcoholic, and by definition, alcoholism is a chronic, fatal, and progressive disease, which means as you age, even though you haven't been drinking, your disease is progressing right along with you. So where a discussion can start on something as small as what's considered one drink, well, for an alcoholic, one drink is, that's the end game, because so far as I know, and I've talked to a lot of alcoholics, there's not any one of us who has ever had just one drink.
You know, and I think for the listeners to also clarify that this is about your personal story, this book, Every Silver Lining Has a Cloud, that is your personal story. And I also have had, you know, so many decades of ancestors that alcohol has just been the name of the game. There mm-hmm. is no other game, and I've experienced it so many different ways, so many different masks on it, and so many different also help or cure, no, we won't call it cures, or help or remedies, mm-hmm. let's put it that way. Or maybe, you know, things that would stop it in its tracks long enough to be able to figure out what they're doing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you and I both have experience, so that's what we'll be sharing with the listeners today.
Yes, absolutely. So, I do have quite a bit of my mm-hmm. personal story in there and my personal feelings. I put in quite a bit of research that has been conducted that I've discovered through my reporting, more of the recent research into the biochemical connection and the genetic connection. I've let the people who are much smarter than I am do the science, and I've put some of my reporting in there alongside my own story and my own anecdotal pieces of the episodes that I've had over a course of drinking 2 liters of Jack Daniels a day, every day, for nearly 2 years. And it was, you know, it took a toll on me. Fortunately, physically, I'm okay. But it also took an emotional toll, and I put the emotion in the book. I put, you know, related it to my family, because it is a family disease. My family suffered greatly as a result of my drinking and my denial about it and my attempts at sobriety and recovery. And finally, you know, they're reaping the benefits of this 24 hours that I've been given today, and God willing, there's another 24 tomorrow. But there are...
But it also, too, don't you believe that alcohol is more like a dance of the day? Because when you have an alcoholic or someone who is drinking or whatever you may want to say, or this tendency to do it or not do it of that day, there's always this dance. And if you think that you're just existing in that own, your own little glass tube, and you don't affect or effect anybody else around you, that's really the type of ego that can really get you in trouble, you know,
right.
Because you really do play off other people around you or other situations around you, and that is exactly the dance mm-hmm. that is what we would call...
From a purely clinical standpoint, this disease is very simple to get into remission. All you need to do is stop drinking and don't drink. Then your disease is in remission. But you're right. We live in the real world, and we have interactions with real people, and stress is a way of life. It's not exclusive to alcoholics. We have the same stresses that everybody else does. We just respond to them differently. And that was one of the things that led to this book, is there has been a lot of research lately into the stress hormone cortisol, and that alcoholics, even those who are in recovery for a number of years, have a higher baseline level of cortisol in their body, so they're more susceptible to stress. When we look at our environment and you look at people's reasons for returning or relapsing into the alcoholism is the stresses around them. So it in isolation, yes, clinically very easy to arrest,
right.
But in practice it is very difficult, and that's why we find that 9 out of 10 alcoholics or ex-drinkers will relapse. And the idea is, let's find what those triggers are, what those emotions are that are leading people right back to the drink. And alcoholics drink for the same reasons that non-alcoholics drink, you know, to relieve the stress, to I had a bad day or I had a good day or I lost my job, the same crummy things or same great things that a non-alcoholic would drink over are the things that are triggers or would lead an alcoholic to say, well, maybe I can handle just one.
And also, too, when they go into rehab or when they, quote, stop drinking for a period of time, that takes a lot of power on their part to be able to do that. But mm-hmm. when they look at it, when they stopped it, they're thinking that that is the only reason that they ended up in that situation, without mm-hmm. also thinking, as you said, the triggers. In other words, how in the heck did I get here in the first place? Because if mm-hmm. I don't ever look how I got here, it will never change. All mm-hmm. it will be doing is like running out of milk in the grocery store, you know? You'll sit mm-hmm. there and you wait until more comes in, you know, for however right. long it takes. You'll just sit there and wait. But if you mm-hmm. don't change what got you there, the reasons why, then nothing will mm-hmm. change that pattern.
And first, getting a person into that rehab, getting him into that state of mind where something's got to change is a really difficult challenge. As you know, families debate right. this and have very heart-wrenching decisions that are done on a family level, and the alcoholic does it on an individual level. This is the only disease that when you have it, it convinces you that you don't have it and that you're perfectly right. fine and I can handle this. And I've been down that path. I thought I could handle this. I thought, no problem. And then I tried to stop drinking on my own. Biggest mistake a lot of alcoholics will make is saying that they can handle it and try to do it on their own. Nearly killed me, because withdrawal from this drug is or can be fatal. And this is one of only two classes of drugs that can kill you during the withdrawal just as easily as it can kill you from using it. So, you know, there's that danger there. But at the very start, when people are talking about getting into rehab, there's such a wall of denial and control. And you hit the word, perfect word, it's ego that jumps in there mm-hmm. to say, no, this is not for me. Part of that, and as we were talking before the show, I'm working on another book that'll be out later this year on stigma, and part of that control thing is the public perception that this is an issue of willpower, and boy, that person's weak, he can't control this.
Right.
Well, you're right, we can't control it, and because it's a disease. I can't will my stomach full when I'm hungry just by thinking about it. I have to do something about it, and that doing something about it, in the case of an alcoholic, is first to detox safely, and second of all, get into a rehabilitation program, whichever method works for you, but to get past that wall of denial, to get through that ego, to actually sit down and say, I have a problem I cannot manage.
And sometimes that's, I think, where so many people struggle right there, is because when you look at a family, let's say, and the alcoholic is starting to get to that point, maybe by, you know, external friends or relationships or work or whatever, sometimes the family of origin is the one that may hold them back, because then therefore that means that the family of origin is the one that may have gotten them there, or the one that's supplying them, or the ones that don't want their dirty laundry exposed in rehab, or they don't want to come down that road with them. There's really nothing wrong with them. We're all the same, can't you see? You know, and that's a pretty dangerous, that's almost like dancing around the fires to see who's going to be the first one to get across the coals, you know? And that is definitely an issue for some that, you know, I live in the South. I live in New Orleans, land of, you can go get fried chicken and a gallon of frozen daiquiris just by driving through, you know, and they're $15 for a gallon of frozen daiquiris. And they don't use regular alcohol. They use the the grain stuff. So it's 120 on up proof, you know. And it is just incredible, the mindset about alcohol. But then the families here don't think anything of that, you know, at all. They started football practice the other day. They said, we're going to do it now because they want to get it over before Mardi Gras because we don't want any of the players coming to practice drunk. Are you kidding? They are underage. Why would you even say something like that?
Why are they drinking in the first place? We have a similar situation up here where I am. I'm from Wisconsin, which is historically or reputationally a drinking culture. We have harsh winters. We have hearty beer drinking German stock up here, and by golly, you're not going to keep us away from our brandy and our beer. Excuse me, but the cultural phenomenon of alcohol in the United States. I mean, we're not alone in this. We have a huge problem in the United States that costs about $227 billion per year in terms of legal costs, in terms of health care costs, in terms of lost productivity. You add all that up, and that's a staggering amount, but there are other countries all over the world. United Kingdom right now is waging a practical war on what they can do about alcoholism because they're drinking culture, but their drinking culture is butting up against a very real economic problem, and that is in lost productivity and two hospital admissions every minute as a result of alcohol or alcohol-related. And then in Australia, they're waging a battle as well with alcoholism, another traditionally drinking culture, that things have suddenly gotten out of hand economically and in terms of violence. There's a great concern about this. It's called the one-punch game, where a bunch of kids kids in their 20s, they're kids to me, will get all liquored up and go out and try to level somebody with one punch. And there's been several deaths that have been high profile, so this has brought out the attention, and suddenly they're looking at this saying, that's not the end of the alcohol violence. That's only the very obvious alcohol violence that is taking place. We have domestic violence problems. So in Australia, United Kingdom, Canada, Ireland, Czech Republic has the reputation and the numbers to back it up as being the most alcohol-consuming populace on the planet, and their economic woes are directly tied to what's going on. So if we look at, you know, get out of our bubble here in the United States and look at what's going on in other countries, we can see that we're overall in denial about what the alcohol is doing economically, what it's doing physically, the list of diseases that are associated with alcohol use, even moderate alcohol use, is staggering, and violence. We have a lot of people who are behind bars in this country and others that ordinarily would not have done the things they had done. However, because they were drinking, lower inhibitions or more aggression, as a result, they end up doing very stupid things and as a result, doing some time for it as well. Drinking and driving is a hot-button issue here, but in the United States, there are more than 90,000 alcohol-related deaths every year, and only 10,000 of those are as a result of driving intoxicated. I think every one of those 10,000, don't get me wrong, every one of those 10,000 is a tragedy. But when we look at overall what alcohol is doing to our health and how alcohol is killing people, it's not just mixing gasoline and alcohol and taking away the keys. The problem is much greater than that. And we're not willing to really do too much about drinking and driving. We want to change the laws. But, you know, we don't want to make it so you can't start your car if you've been drinking, because that would keep us from drinking at all. And that's where those other 80,000 of the 90,000 deaths are coming from, and that we're drinking ourselves into an early grave. On average, it costs us 18 years of life expectancy. It's a toxin. It's mm-hmm. it's killing people, and it's not just on the roadways. So if we're not willing to go to any length to take alcohol off the roads, then mm-hmm. you know, then that reveals a much bigger problem than that we're not willing to address what it's doing as a health care issue or as an economic issue.
Well, I think that comes down to the same thing with responsibility and patient and healthcare these days. I mean, even mm-hmm. with cancer, you know, everybody says, well, why did my doctor see it before? Whose responsibility is it that he didn't find it now at stage four? Mm-hmm. You know, or all of a sudden I'm sick and I'm dying and you're telling me I have 6 months, but I came to see you last six months too. Or, but I'm going to eat whatever I want, but that's okay, just give me the medicine, you know. Or mm-hmm. I'm going to do whatever I want to do, it's okay, you know, I have insurance. Or, mm-hmm. I mean, there is a huge bulletin board here in the South, and it has an elderly woman, rather heavy set, and she's an older woman, and it says, the line across it, it says, do what you wanna. Exactly printed like that. And on the bottom it says, because we're here for you, and it's the hospital name. So, I mean, really to have to be able to have a culture that will be able to start saying what is responsibility for yourself. And really, mm-hmm. you know, that's where you come with these things. Nobody really wants to be told they can't drink. Why not? It's sold at the grocery stores. Why can't I go get it? You know, so that's something that's pretty hard to even drive home, you know, anymore. You know, I want to do it because I want to do it. So let's say after people get a, let's say they're getting in help and they're stopping the drinking and everything. Let's start talking about maybe the symptoms you talk about of sobriety. Because there's so many times that people will say, I'm good to go, I'm going to go home, and hey, everything is hunky-dory, and it's like, whoa, wait, because that wall of fire is just waiting for that last drop of kerosene. Because it's got to happen. Don't you believe? I mean, no matter who stops, no matter where they go, no matter how many hundreds of thousands they paid for that rehab, sure as I'm sitting here, they're all going to hit that inferno flame.
Mm-hmm. What I touched on earlier about the cortisol is very easily identified when it gets out of control, because I pulled out seven symptoms that the cortisol is getting out of control, which means that, hey, you're losing control of your sobriety. And control is kind of a goofy word that we don't like to use in alcoholism, but it just means that the cortisol is telling you you've got a problem that you need to be paying attention to, or you're going to lose that hard-fought sobriety and recovery. And when you have excess cortisol in your body, it feels like you have poor memory recall. Neglecting your sleep, rest, or eating, you know, the basics are falling by the wayside. Confusion, and this was a really big red flag for me that I never caught, and I've relapsed a couple of times. And confusion, if I look back, those days and weeks before I relapsed, my confusion, lack of clear thinking, I used to think mm-hmm. I would be able to just be able to come up quickly with a solution or come up quickly with an answer. I couldn't put together two coherent sentences because I just couldn't think clearly at that point. Emotional sensitivity, you're irritable or weepy. That's another sign that the cortisol levels are spiking, and that as a result, your stress level's going out, and there's going to be one more trigger that pushes you over the edge. If you have substitution cravings and habits that you're overdoing, for example, smoking, eating chocolate, biting your nails, those other things that you did when you stopped drinking, all of a sudden you're doing them more and more, that's a sign that the cortisol is getting out of control. Isolation, you just want to be left alone. Leave me alone, another sign. And also, this is was originally identified in people with post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD, and that's a hyper-alertness or a hypersensitivity. Easily startled. You have an exaggerated startle response, and I've come up against that one myself as well. When you know, I was staying with my mother, and you know, she's a very quiet person, but she could come up behind me, and I would jump right out of my skin because I had this exaggerated startle response. I saw that in my own experience as well as what they've documented with the cortisol. So those seven things are signs that it's not necessarily imminent, but a relapse is possible because your cortisol levels, your stress level is it's reaching a brink, and then you're going to get into other lures, other triggers like being hungry, angry, lonely, tired, depressed, or just have the right buddy come along at the right time and say, hey, let's get a drink. And at that point, like I said, we drink for the same reasons that non-alcoholics drink. It feels good. We want that relaxed. We want, because, you know what, the one thing that lowers cortisol is alcohol. That's one of the great paradoxes of this disease. The one thing that relieves our stress is the one thing that's going to kill us.
And also, too, there's a lot of people who do like a high, which stress, when you get all hyped up and you want to feel stressed and you just want to feel that buzz, you want to feel that extra anxious going, there are these people who have to be at that level of that buzz, and they feel or they think that that will keep them there, when in actuality it does just the opposite. It takes them off of there.
Right. It's a depressant.
But then they're in that dive, you know?
Mm-hmm. And you always run into, when you're chemically dependent, you run into a situation, whether it's heroin, whether it's cocaine, where the old amount isn't going to be enough. And and that's one of the signs of alcoholism, when your tolerance increases, the stuff that brought you to that high. And I refer to those people half-jokingly as alcoholics in training. They may not be chemically dependent at that point. They're still enjoying themselves. Drinking is still fun to some extent for them. But when they cross that line from being an alcoholic into training until, oh, this isn't so much fun anymore, there are legal consequences, there are family consequences, or maybe there aren't any type of physical consequences, any type of consequences, but it's just that I'm drinking more and more, and I'm not getting that high, I'm not getting that buzz on, and then you're running into a situation where you have a higher tolerance. And why do you have a higher tolerance? Because you're chemically dependent. This is a drug, and that's where some people who are addicted to other drugs often fall into a trap. They say, well, I quit my drug of choice, and I can drink alcohol, right? No, alcohol is a drug, too. And what alcoholics, or what is commonly not seen in public literature or public discussion, is that alcohol is our leading drug of abuse in this country.
Yeah. And also, too, even if you're not an alcoholic or if you are hiding it with a mask, so many times people would come into my office and they would be just plain burnt out. I mean, literally burnt like nobody's business. They just simply have no more gas to keep on going. And that is, the same thing. Their cortisol has just burnt out. They just don't have any more. They're in adrenal fatigue. And you can find alcoholics eventually where they do end up with alcohol, just totally adrenal fatigue. You really have got to start, basic core health parameters to be able to start to feel better, so that all your normal senses of, your adrenal different type of hormones that are coming out of there will actually start regenerating themselves, because you can actually burn them out, which is a lot of times when you have somebody that is such a burnt-out alcoholic and they go and they get in a car wreck and they're not even hurt, but everybody else is killed, They're just so burnt out. It doesn't even faze them. It's sort of like they're just, as we've said before, just dancing through life. They're almost like ghosts. They don't even get affected by it. It doesn't even do anything to them anymore. And that's really a dangerous place.
It is. I'm glad you brought up the adrenal fatigue. The adrenal glands produce that cortisol, but they also produce epinephrine, and they tie into the whole body's biochemistry and our brain's ability to produce dopamine and serotonin. And when the adrenals get depleted, then as a result, we have the problem with excess dopamine in the brain as well, and then you almost become, I believe the term is anhedonic, where you're unable to experience any kind of joy, any kind of pleasure,
right.
anything. It's just you're
burnt out.
No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. You're just totally burnt out. There's just nothing else to be able to work. And a lot of times people say, okay, it's because your cortisol too. But then now, let's say we want to try to get better afterwards. You really have to work on the foods and, you know, the other items to be able to have your adrenals start to work better. But also what we call cofactors, you have to be eating right. You have to be sleeping right. You have to be doing something every single day. It's not just, I'm going to stop drinking. I'm going to sit here. I'm going to good to go. And, hey, you know, I'm going to just keep doing whatever I've been doing otherwise. All of your things have to change. You can't just say one thing is going to change, right? I'm sure you had to change the way you ate or slept or, you know, your health, just as we've said. You can keep riding down that, you know, that car on those bald tires, but it's all going to give. You can't just keep saying, I'm going to keep putting gas in and it's going to go. It's not. It's going to quit.
One of the big problems that I had in early sobriety, and this goes back to what I drank and the way I drank, it was just simple hydration. For a period of 2 years, I drank straight alcohol constantly throughout the day just to be a maintenance drinker, to keep myself from going through withdrawal because I was terrified
right.
of the shakes. But I didn't drink much water. And as a result, when you dehydrate your body constantly for a period of months or, in my case, a couple of years, that takes a physical toll on your tissues as well. So in terms of my own health, I had to begin drinking water, and it's a habit that I've gotten into today where I make a point of staying well hydrated because I know how awful my body feels when I was dehydrated. And it wasn't just the alcohol in my body. It was the lack of water. And alcohol also displaces any of the water that I did have. So I was running a pretty severe water H2O deficit in my body.
A double negative.
Food, yeah. Mm-hmm. The foods that, the energy foods, getting away from the fried foods. I love French fries like the next guy. Don't take away my French fries, but you know what? They're the ones that kind of drag me down, and I like a little bit of energy. So I get energy from food, and I think when I speak with people who are going through rehab centers, you look at the kind of foods that are available, and yeah, they do have starchy foods because a lot of people have
right.
just neglected their health and they need to put on some weight, but they also have plenty
right.
of fresh fruits and vegetables, and they're constantly available, milk, water. We drink a lot of coffee both in those 12-step meetings and also in rehab. It's one of those common substitutions, that and smoking, for worse, actually, not for better or worse. It's replacing one drug with another, but the idea that there are more healthy alternatives right there at the rehab gets people into a pattern, into a habit of reaching for the apple rather than driving through the McDonald's or ordering the bar food that they normally eat and eating something that's a little bit more healthy and easily digestible. Definitely the water for me, though.
What are you finding is the biggest culprit that will start many people, and obviously it's never, ever the same for everybody, but, you know, this after rehab and then you start doing your 12 steps if you choose to do so or go to meetings, like guilt and shame and penance. Let me tell you, I don't hear the word penance used very much, but when you hear people talking, and I've gone to many meetings myself and to many rehab places, is that it's this idea of penance. They sort of say they're going to do it because they have to do it, or I'm going to do it because they told me to do it, or I'm going to do it because God's expecting it of me. You know, all of this, like, in other words, it always has that little ding on it, little charm on that little, you know, that ball and chain that always says it's penance, you know? And that really doesn't let you off or take care of the business. All it's really doing is prolonging until the day, until what we call before the wall of inferno again, you know, because penance will get you nowhere, right?
Right. Well, the 12-step world likes to use the word make amends, and in my book I spend a whole chapter talking about forgiveness as one of the four key stressors that trip up people and in their recovery and make them relapse. And whether you're seeking forgiveness, whether somebody's not forgiving you, that is amends, forgiveness, that all ties into you. It's not about them. And that's where the 12-step programs are really focused. You're releasing yourself. You're not asking for absolution for what you did, if you did something terrible. You're not shunning your own responsibility for that. But what you are doing is releasing that from your pack of baggage, so to speak. And forgiveness is one of the four hot buttons that I touch on in the book. Shame is a big one. Guilt, forgiveness, shame, and grief. And grief is also a very big cause of relapse. And it's not just grieving as you would think about funerals or deaths or anything, but it's also taking time to grieve your past, to grieve your lifestyle. Mm-hmm. For a lot of people, a lot of alcoholics, that was their lifestyle. Going out on Friday night, meet the old buddies, going to the bars, or sitting there at home in front of the TV watching the same programs, drinking the same bottle of gin or the same brand of gin. Your patterns, your lifestyle has changed, and you need to take a little bit of time to bury that, to mourn it, to grieve over it, and then to let it go. And a lot of people, especially when they get straight out of rehab, it's called the pink cloud. They're, wow, this is great. I feel better for the first time in months or years, and everything is great, and people are smiling at me, and I finally found my smile. But yeah, what they haven't taken care of is grieving, okay, that old me can't exist anymore.
Right. And sometimes they've taken so much energy and perfection in putting on that mask and designing it and coloring it and knowing who to show it to and who to not to show it to, and you know, and how to like turn on the electric lights every time, you know, in other words, who you want to be to show to the world, that when rehab and these things take that mask away and say we have to burn the mask. You know, really, you get a lot of people coming out that have no clue who they are. And that type of self-discovery is sometimes much harder when you're around people who are expecting you to be that mask. And then that mask is gone, and they're like, they start poking at you. You almost feel like you're like a new baby that was just born. What are you doing? Why aren't you doing that? Who are you? Where are you going? Why are you in that da-da-da-da-da stuff, you know? And they're just trying to, like, checking you out. And it's like, stop checking me out, you know? I'm the same person I always was. It's just I don't have my mask on. But they're not familiar with that. And then they start saying, are you going to drink again? Are you not drinking again? And then there goes that whole mountain. I mean, it's almost like you're a baby, like, people are sticking these little stickers on you, who you are and who you're supposed to be, and how hard that is to change.
And you're right. It's a change of identity, and you do that in rehab or you do that in your early sobriety, whether you have rehab or a program. You feel this change or this metamorphosis in yourself, and then other people are kind of looking at you like, wow, you're not drinking, or, you know, this isn't the Scott I know. Well, yeah, I'm still the same Scott, just a little bit more sober today. And I feel, in speaking with a lot of alcoholics, for every silver lining has a cloud, in that, you know, nobody expects a shrine to be built in our honor just because we sobered up. We don't want that. Right. it's not realistic and it's not necessary. We would just like the stigma around the alcoholism around us drinking when we drank, and now that we're recovered because we chose not to drink, just that stigma to just kind of turn into some vapor and go away, because we're just trying to live a life without the expectations. And that kind of ties into shame, where some people will have the expectation that you come out of alcoholic rehab and you're expected to be perfect, you're expected to walk on water, you have this fulfilling spiritual life, never make mistakes, never have any of the other problems like eating disorders, like non-alcoholics regularly pull these things off. But the expectation is there because you made this change, and frankly, in my case, you're kind of a jerk before. You better really wise up and walk a straight line this time. And that expectation, that shame built in there is it's hard to live up to, and it's also the shame is a big stressor. It's one of those four areas that lead to relapse.
Yeah, and it is really difficult when you have people around you who don't really know anything about the situation, and they seem to continue to perpetuate how they were also. In other words, you know, let's say every Friday, don't forget, we're going here, you know, and make sure you're there by 3 o'clock because that's when happy hour starts, you know, or don't forget, I mean, here in the South, it's 25 cent martinis on Friday. The restaurant is packed like nobody's business because you got to be there by 10:30 to get a table. I mean, really? You know?
Wow.
By then, do you even think anybody even eats? Nobody even eats.
Nope.
They order the food and then they take it home with them. I mean, it's incredible to see people leaving almost every person out of a restaurant with a go box. It's because they drank for the whole first hour they were there.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Now they're taking their food home because they can't possibly stuff it down. And it's so different, you know, as you go around the country, like you've said, where you live and where I live. I know when I lived in Scottsdale, Arizona, you know, it was a lot of just wine days, you know. Women would have the wine days. In California, oh, my goodness, you know, it was nothing to have a case of wine in the back of your car. It just was the way it was. But then when you went to Florida, you know, I didn't see it so much in Florida, you know, in different age groups. You know, and then you're looking in different areas, you know, maybe South Carolina and stuff. You know, you didn't have it in restaurants all the time. You know, I've gotten used to, you know, if a fast food place doesn't serve liquor, what's wrong with it? You know, and in some states, you can't even get it in restaurants because they don't have liquor licenses. So there's so many things around the country. I think you really, too, as you get out of rehab and you start changing yourself and changing your life to prevent triggers, you may need to relocate. You may need to go to a different place because you just don't need to say, every time I want to get chicken, I have to be asked if I want a daiquiri, right? You may need to move, and you may need to be away from all of that type of patterns that are going on.
That's very true, and the problem that we see with alcoholism is some people will view that as a cure rather than something to do after you've been to rehab. They think there's a geographic solution. I'm drinking like a madman in Milwaukee, but if I move to Sarasota, I'm gonna quit. I'm gonna be a different man. Some people can pull that off, usually not for very long, because they haven't addressed what else is going on. But after rehab, you're right that changing the environment that certainly may have fostered or may bring up triggers, bring up emotions, you know, those old routines, you may just have to get away from them after rehab, after detoxing, getting a healthy start on your body rather than relying on that geography to do it for you.
And I think also, too, we talk about age groups. I do not think that there is any age group that is ever exempt. You can see a fall down under the bridge drunk at the age of 15 as you could of an 80 or a 90-year-old. There is no one that's exempt. Man, woman, child, I'm sorry, doesn't cut it. I see it all the time. I mean, even high-ranking politicians in this state, you know, and the others in the South have their kids who are just not even out of high school yet, drove down the street and wrecked all the cars.
Mm-hmm.
But, oh, okay, we're just going to put them in jail for 5 hours till we can get them back out. And there's no consequences anymore, I don't think, for the problems that we've, you know, had with this liquor in some states. It's just so profound that they are not going to make any changes. I mean, even here now, they have IV places that are turning into huge, huge medical business. Why would a medical professional say that I'm going to start giving IVs to drunks because they have a really bad hangover so they can go out and handle the next day?
Yeah,
well, sometimes those really bad hangovers is what got their butt fired or what got them butt kicked out, right? And
or
then
what
if
got
you're
them
turning around and rescuing them and say, no problem, you go out 3 o'clock in the morning, here comes the bus down the street, we're going to take you, we'll hook you up in an IV right here, right now. And it's like, wow.
Yeah,
you know, how
really
far are we coming?
Mm-hmm. That's a very questionable ethical practice. If you're, you know, you're making it easier for them to get sicker because essentially you're just encouraging them to put more alcohol in their body rather than, and then I don't know how these places operate, if they're handing out any literature. I would highly doubt it, but, you know,
right.
If there's any kind of counseling that goes along with it to say, do you know why you feel like garbage, and do you know why you're going to feel like garbage tomorrow, and why this IV is only a short-term solution to a much bigger, bigger problem? I don't know if that goes on down there. I'm very shocked to hear that this is becoming a norm down by you. I'm surprised up here in the Midwest where we've been below freezing for 3 weeks straight. So, you know, that's the kind of weather where you hunker down indoors and, well, you get bored, you get cabin fever, and a lot of people drink their way out of it until spring,
right,
until that groundhog comes out of the ground. But you brought up an interesting point, and I did a piece on this right around the time that Philip Seymour Hoffman died of his overdose, in that, you know, drugs, including alcohol, do not discriminate.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter what your income is.
No.
Doesn't matter what your age is, your celebrity status, or any of that stuff. And in looking at the number breakdown, my generation, I was born in 1967, and our average age of first use of alcohol was 14. And now, today, 25 years later, it's age 12 is the average age.
Right.
So as I was working with the school, the school advisory committee the other day, the subject came up, when do we start talking to kids? And, you know, they're talking about high school education. No, we got to start talking to kids in the middle grades and in elementary school because that's when they're making that first decision. And we can talk all we want in the schools about this, but their number one source of information and the pattern is set by the parents. What they get at home.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, what's even worse is I turn around and I see, you know, parents going to the drive-thrus and they get their styrofoam cups. They're these big, big gulp sizes.
Mm-hmm.
And they put it with their daiquiris and they put it in their car. And the kids just go up and drink out of them. And I'm shocked and I just find it. Sometimes I just get this and I just don't even know, you know, and I know that this is only here, but I know what's going on in other places. It's just that people are saying different things about it. So really, it's all, like you said, up there it's cold. Well, hey, it's great. I'm loving that it's cold because I can get stone butt drunk and nobody will know. And when the sun comes up, I'll come back out, you know?
Right.
So they can hide really well. So people have become really finesse with their ways of hiding things, I think, too.
Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that as alcoholics we become very good at it, and that's protecting our supply, getting it, making sure we've got it, and making sure nobody's going to take it away from us. And
right.
whether it's holding up for the winter or sneaking it around in big styrofoam cups, we find a way to continue to give us what we need chemically once we're dependent.
Right.
One of the things you mentioned, the youth going through the drive-thrus and picking up things. One of the things, I've been working with a group called Alcohol Justice out of California, and they're very focused on Alka-Pops, which are the malt beverages that are flavored very sweet, big cans, high alcohol content. And even though the alcohol pop or Alka-Pop manufacturers have kind of won a battle but not the war in getting a court case to say that, well, no, you're not targeting them toward children. The idea with these big, attractive, flashy cans and high alcohol content but yet tastes like a soda is that, yeah, they're going to appeal to younger people. And Alcohol Justice has been working with communities on getting bans, because the sad fact of the matter is that we are creating the next generation of alcoholics faster than we're addressing the recovery needs of the current generation of alcoholics.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, too, here in the South, we've had a lot of instances where people making Jell-O shots, and the kids think it's Jell-O, and they put it in their lunch, and they take it to school. And it's absolutely incredible to even think that that would even occur. But it does. Or
and
parents making wine pops now, you know, those popsicles out of wine, because it's cold, so now they're starting to do that, you know. But so we look at so many of these things that happen to people, and we look at how hard it is to be able to stop drinking, and how hard it is to be able to convince someone that there is something better to stop drinking, because there's so much peer pressure. There's so much out there in the social media. There's so much everywhere to support it, and there's really very little to support stopping it. And I think that's where your book has definitely listed a lot of, you know, the symptoms that you really need to be able to make some changes. And those changes are really more about yourself. The alcohol is part of it. But if, like we've said before, if you can't figure out how you got there in the first place, what makes it better, worse, or same, and where you're going to go from here, you really are not going to get there. Because if you don't have a plan, you know, you can't just say, hey, look at me, world, I stopped. And if you don't have a plan for the next second, I don't think you're going to get there, do you?
No, you won't. And where I address in Every Silver Lining Has a Cloud, where I address the key component here in maintaining your recovery is keep communicating. You need to keep talking to people. I personally go to 12-step meetings, and I've been to other types of meetings like Smart Recovery, which is self-management, and there's Women for Sobriety, Secular Order of Sobriety, Celebrate Recovery. There's any number of meetings there. I'm not advocating one. I don't care if you go to the meeting for crop circles, as long as you're going to a meeting and talking to people who are going through the same kind of things that you are going through. Because, first of all, you need to keep your mouth moving, because you're going to eventually come out with some of your emotions, and you're going to come out with something that is troubling you. And if we talk about the things that we don't talk about, then we go a long way to maintaining our recovery. And in communicating through those meetings and through one-on-one, we can build a more solid foundation for recovery rather than just isolating, rather than just winging it. And the other great thing about communicating is somebody can always see your blind spots a lot better than you can. You might be talking, and what is coming out of your mouth might be a gigantic red flag to somebody else, and you might not even realize it. And they can, you know, take you by the arm, and it's happened to me more than once, and say, "Hey, do you listen to yourself? Do you hear what's coming out of your mouth? Because it sounds like you're thinking, going back to some ways of thinking that didn't really work out so well for you in the past." And having someone have your six, as they say in the Navy or in the fighter pilots, you know, having somebody watching you over you, and being able to have the kind of dialogue. And, you know, us alcoholics, we refer to non-alcoholics as normies, and normies don't get it, these normal people. But talking to another alcoholic and having them understand the same language that you're talking to goes a long way in preserving your recovery. And again, I don't care what type of meeting a person goes to, or if it's just one-on-one, as long as they're keeping a dialogue going, being assertive, communicating, getting out what they're feeling, then they're doing a lot to preserve their recovery. And that's what every silver lining has a cloud is about, is preserving that recovery, identifying the things that we should be talking about, like the shame, the guilt, talking through them rather than drinking over them.
Because you do need what I call peeps. You need people around you who will listen. You don't need people who are observers. You don't need people who are just, you know, out for themselves or, you know, just dragging you along for the ride. You need peeps. You need people who listen. Because, like you just said, you need someone that's going to hear something that you're saying or not saying and be able to be there for you. I mean, there's such a great culture right now of people saying, I'm your friend or I'm your acquaintance or I'm your family. And sure as I'm sitting here, I've had this happen to myself on a daily basis. They don't hear. They heard what you said, the words. They heard sound coming out of your mouth. But if you turned around and asked them, what did I just say? I can guarantee you 99% of the people cannot repeat what you said. And when if they can, they don't know what it means, and they just passed it by in their head anyway. So you really need those people that would be listening to you. And I think sometimes when you're in a meeting, you know, you have a lot of people there. Someone is going to listen to something you have said. Law of averages. You'll come out of there somehow, some way, so that somebody will help be there for you. And I think that support is what you need, because you can't just have the same group of small people that you've always had and expect them to change and be what you need, when really you just need to go find those others for yourself.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, we've come to the end of the show. Scott, I'd like to thank you so much for being with us. Could you give us your website and how people could find out more information about you and where to purchase the book? That would be great.
Sure. Every Silver Lining Has a Cloud is available at all the online booksellers. That would be Amazon, Barnes & Noble, et cetera. In fact, anywhere you are, if you type into your browser's search bar, viewbook.at/alcoholism, that'll take you directly to my page on Amazon. But also, like I said, it's available on Kobo, on Barnes & Noble, any other bookseller online. Your local bricks and mortar bookstore will also have Every Silver Lining Has a Cloud, but usually it's a special order item. And I have a web page. My website is alcoholologist.com. And on there, you can click on any of the links for iTunes or Barnes & Noble. That'll get you where you want. Also, I have a spot on Facebook for the book, but it's also on my reporting. So I cover some of the health issues like alcohol's connection to cancer and all the other reporting that I do. And that's Every Silver Lining Has a Cloud on Facebook. So any one of those ways, alcoholologist.com or Every Silver Lining or Amazon, you name it, that's where you can find it. It's available as an e-book for Kindle and other electronic readers, also available as a soft cover and a hard cover.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today. It was a real pleasure. It's definitely a topic that a lot of people do need to hear something about, but a lot of people don't want to talk about it, and they just don't want to hear about it even more, don't you think?
I think that's so true, and we do need to have the discussion a lot more with how much this affects every person in our economy, but also every person in our families.
Well, thank you so much for being with us.
You bet. Thank you, Dr. Jeanette.
Great. Have a great night. Thank you.
You do the same. Bye.
If you'd like more information about Scott's book, the links are on today's show page. Also, the link directly to his website is included on today's show page. You just click directly through there, and you will go right in so you could be able to purchase the book, or you'll be able to find out more information. And also, Scott has a link where you can purchase the book. Yes, I have the Amazon one on the show page, yes. So if you'd like more information, please do visit his website. If you'd like more information and you're not able to get what you need, please do send me an email via the show page. Thank you so much for being with us today, and have a great evening.